The Jay Young Show is a weekly podcast featuring insightful discussions with anyone from big business CEOs, celebrities, to military heroes. Each interview is a personal conversation about business, life, and anything in between. And now, your host, Jay Young.
Hey, everybody. Another episode of Jay Young Show. I tell you, we had a great guest today, Michael Harris. We're going to talk about Wall Street, man. What's it like to be on Wall Street? Have you ever thought about that? There's Gordon Gekko. There's all these different people that have done the Wall Street deal. And I mean, you know, little boy like me, I've never even thought about Wall Street or what happens when the tickers go and the bells ring and all that. Never thought about it. But man, we've got a live one on the show today. Michael Harris is going to show us all about what it's like and how to be successful on Wall Street. Michael, thanks for coming on the show today.
Oh, thanks, Jay. I really appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. And I really look forward to this because, man, I mean, I became a stockbroker in 85 before the crash in 87 and learned a few things about that, but never really had success as a broker. Didn't know how and when and where, and I didn't have that. And I want to learn now, and that's what our show is. Our show is for 16 to 20-year-olds and listening to this and finding that person that they can connect with to become successful and not have to live all the heartaches that we had to along the way. So I really look forward to that. And Michael, if you will, let's just start off with, the very beginning. You know, can I tell something about yourself, your background, the schooling, and then how did you get to Wall Street? What did that look like?
Yeah. So I grew up just outside of Washington, D.C. in suburban Maryland. My mom was a school teacher, and my dad actually was one of the early technologists at IBM. Funny enough, though, he used to joke that he was so early to technology that he didn't make the kind of money that people over the last 25 years have made in that space. But he was a programmer and ran mainframe computers that are, as you and I remember, in some cases, as big as the building that you and I are sitting in right now. And you think about my iPhone probably is more powerful than that computer was, but it took someone to run it and he did that. And, I think as our conversation progresses, you'll learn that I love education. I love learning, but more importantly, I love imparting it to others. And that's why I'm so excited to be on today's show. As far as how I got into investing, it's actually a great story. So my mom's father, maternal grandfather, was an investor. He didn't work on Wall Street. He actually worked in your industry, oil and gas, for a company called American Oil. And when he retired, some guys take up golf. Others like to fish. He became absolutely infatuated with Wall Street and investing. And though he didn't have a lot of money, he was really passionate about doing research, finding good companies, investing in them and tracking them. And, I was kind of his little buddy. And when I was in first or second grade on one of his visits, he was showing me some of his stocks in the Wall Street Journal. And I just, immediately was taken by it. And he did one of the greatest things. So for my next birthday, he bought me shares in an initial public offering or IPO. And it was in a company that you'll probably remember, since I know you're a baseball fan like I am. There was a company called Topps, T-O-P-P-S, that made baseball cards. And yep, as a young fan of the game, I collected baseball cards. So he bought me stock in the IPO, and I had this little notebook. And every week when he came to visit, we would look up the share price in the Wall Street Journal. And I had a little chart going, and we would talk about earnings and other headlines that impacted the stock. And I was hooked. I mean, I'll never forget. I got a check about 6 months later from the company, and I was crushed. I thought my grandfather sold me out of my shares and I was getting my money back. And in fact, it was a dividend check. And so when he came, he said, no, you own part of this company. They had a good year and they're sharing some of those profits with you as an owner of the company. And that's when it clicked for me. That's when it was like, wow, this is amazing. You mean if I can go out and find great companies, I don't even have to make the widgets that they're making and selling. I can just by selecting them and investing in them, I can see, you know, profitability on the back of that. And honestly, you know, a lot of people go off to, you know, to college and graduate school having no idea what they want to do with their lives. I knew in first grade that I was heading into finance.
Wow, that is great. That's a great story. You get a check in the mail and you're thinking, wow, this is granted I sold my shares, but instead you got a dividend check and thinking, wow, passive income at its best. You know, and how to do that. So that's great. So how did you prepare for this career on Wall Street? I mean, you just all of a sudden you graduate high school, go to college, and then walked up and started knocking on doors, or how did you how did that work?
So the first thing I started doing, and I'm sure that this will be useful to everyone listening, I started reading books about finance, about folks that had careers on Wall Street. I think you and I can probably agree that aside from, you know, history and military history, you know, Wall Street has got more books written about it than pretty much any other topic out there. I mean, just go on Amazon and you'll find thousands of books. Everything from textbooks to people stories to fun reads. So I just started, you know, getting my hands on as many books about, you know, Wall Street as I could. Was reading them up through high school. Actually, with a friend of mine, we started an investment club, and we're kind of doing some, you know, fictitious trading, paper trading of various stocks, coming up with different trading strategies and just talking about them as high school students. And then as I prepared to go to college, you know, I had a great mentor in high school. It was a friend of mine's father who was in banking and done a lot of work around investments. And I was asking him, you know, I'm looking at universities and I'm trying to figure out what should I major in? Should I major in finance? Should I major in business administration? And he was actually the one that pointed me towards economics. He said, you know, economics is so broad-based, it drives everything in the market. So you need to have a good understanding. And he said, listen, if you want to get into business administration, you're going to get an MBA in grad school anyway. So why start so specialized in undergrad? Start broad and then specialize from there, which was a great piece of advice. Then the other thing that he told me that really changed my life was he said, you got to go beyond that. You need to differentiate yourself with an additional skill. And I said, okay, I'm all ears. What do you think? And he said, I really think, and remember, this is late 80s, early 90s, I think the world is going global. And if, particularly on Wall Street, you know, right now, as an example, one of the biggest countries that's having an impact on the markets from an investment standpoint is Japan. So he's just throwing it out there. But he said, what if you were to study Japanese in college and you were one of the few guys, you know, up in New York that could not only work with the Japanese, but could speak their language and understand their customs. And I said, wow, I said, that's a great idea. I said, well, what if I can't do that? He said, well, you know, there are other languages you could learn. And that was, he said, you know, you could also study a computer language. You could learn how to code, which I thought, looking back, I mean, we would obviously tell young people to study coding or something like it in technology now. But to say that in the early 90s, it was genius. So when I got to Gettysburg College, where I got my degree, you know, I majored in economics. I declared a second major in Japanese. I studied abroad for a year in Japan and learned as much as I possibly could. And I took as many computer science courses as I could. I had a healthy understanding, remember, because my dad was a programmer. And so I had learned to code BASIC as a young child and was very passionate about technology. But really, it was kind of pulling all of those things together that I think, you know, gave me the resume that enabled me to get that first job on the street.
Wow, that's a great story. Really, really good. So you get your own Wall Street, you finish up. What are you some of the most accomplishments or biggest accomplishments that you've had that you're most proud of?
Gosh, I mean, I'm proud of so much, but if I were to sum it up, I just, you know, and I think that once again, I was very fortunate that I prepared so early. I got started before a lot of my peers, right? And so getting my first job literally 3 months before I graduated college, and I'll never forget the HR director saying, you know, can you start in 2 weeks? I said, I'm still in school. She said, okay, when do you graduate? I said, May 15th. She said, that's a Saturday. And I said, I could start Monday. And I didn't think she'd actually take me up on the offer. And she said, great, I'll put you down for May 17th. So I graduated on a Saturday. I drove to New York City, packed everything up on a Sunday, and started at 8 a.m. in the World Trade Center on Wall Street my first day on that Monday. So really kind of getting ahead of things. For me, it was always not just what I accomplished, but in the timeline. So when I finally, you know, after spending some time on the sell side and building portfolios of hedge funds at Dean Witter and then Morgan Stanley, becoming a broker at Revco and trading for some of the largest hedge funds in the world, and then going down to Campbell in Baltimore to serve as a trader, within about 6 years, I had climbed through the ranks and at the young age of 31, I was global head of trading for a multi-billion dollar hedge fund, kind of looking after all of our trading in New York, Europe, Asia, across currencies, futures, derivatives, equities. That was a huge milestone for me. And then a few years later, when I was 37, being named president of the firm, one of the largest and oldest hedge funds in the world, and being able to run my own fund before only, you know, the age of 40. But if there's one thing in my career that I think really stood out and I was incredibly proud of, I served 6 years on the board of what's called the Managed Funds Association, which is a global trade association for hedge funds and alternative investments. And basically what that means is it was a group of hedge funds, the largest in the world, who get together, go to Washington and other capital cities in the world, and they talk to policymakers and regulators and really help them understand the benefits of our industry and how we're helping, you know, pensioners, you know, across the world and the country to meet their retirement needs. We help diversify portfolios. And so I got to go to Capitol Hill multiple times and testify, the White House, the Treasury Department. But probably the pinnacle for me was getting to go to the Federal Reserve at least once a year, sit at that big board table across from, you know, the likes of Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen, Jay Powell, and just have a conversation with them about what we were seeing in the markets, what we were worried about as far as risk factors. It was just, you know, as particularly as an economist sitting at that table, you just realize, I don't know that it's going to get any better than this, Jay.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. That is really, really good. And I mean, you make it sound pretty easy. Like, I mean, it's like, man, you put a couple of things in place, you become bilingual, you learn Wall Street, you learn the hedge fund business. I mean, so I know it wasn't easy, and I'm just saying that, you know, because we're sitting here just talking. But I mean, what is it that was some of the hardest things you had to overcome?
You know, I think that, you know, there's a lot of competition, first off. I mean, to your point, it wasn't easy. There were a lot of people that wanted, you know, the seats that I was able to capture over time. And my mentality was always, you know, if I get up earlier, if I stay up later, if I work weekends, if I'm constantly doing research and, you know, studying to become better, reading more books about the industry, then hopefully I'm going to be able to stay ahead of the competition. But it was tough, and there definitely were setbacks along the way. I mean, that's part of life. And I think the important thing is I surrounded myself with good people, friends, family, associates. I had some great mentors along the way, like the one I mentioned in high school. I had a couple throughout my career. Mark Hawley, the guy that hired me, literally sight unseen, my first job on Wall Street. You know, Bob Murray, who went on to run another hedge fund, Graham Capital, was a great first boss and somebody that I looked up to throughout my career. Even Keith Campbell, the founder of my hedge fund, was a tremendous, you know, someone that I looked to as just an incredible thought leader and was able to bounce ideas off of. And having these people when I had setbacks that I could go to and just be open and honest with them and get their feedback. And they were great about just, you know, sometimes hitting me right between the eyes and saying, Mike, you've just said it. You've missed the obvious. You know, you just got to go back and pick up the pieces and start all over again. Maybe try it a different way, take a different tack. And, you know, as I said, we all have success, but along with that comes failure. And I always tell people, you learn more from your failures than you ever do from your success. Right. So it's important to you know, focus on that, ask for feedback and then grow.
Right. I mean, you see on Wall Street, you know, the Jordan Belfort movie, I mean, the you know, the off $100 bills, and you're thinking, oh man, anybody can do that. And but there is a tremendous amount of hard work and competition, like you said, and just making sure that you're on top, you're doing the right thing. People see that, they recognize it. You're working weekends. I mean, you're no telling how many hours a week you're putting in. It takes a tremendous amount of dedication. It just doesn't happen overnight. And there is no 4-hour work week on Wall Street, I don't believe.
No, not so. If there is, let me know, Jay, because I missed that memo.
Oh my gosh, that's unbelievable. So what is some of the biggest major takeaways running your own hedge fund? And that would be awesome to run your own hedge fund. Is that easy? Is that easy to do? How many people are involved, and what kind of assets did you own?
Yeah. So at our peak, Campbell was almost $14 billion back in 2007, which, you know, put us in the top 10, if not top 20, largest hedge funds in the world. So we were a big player. And when you think about the leverage on top of that, I mean, the orders of magnitude, just the orders alone that were going through our trading desk were absolutely massive and market moving in almost everything we touched. So we had to be very careful about everything we did, how we did it, and obviously staying as anonymous as we possibly could in the marketplace. I learned a ton. I mean, we could spend the entire hour just talking about hedge funds, but a couple things kind of come to mind. First off, you know, I really haven't watched the show. I can't bring myself to do it, but I have watched enough to know that the hedge fund world is very different than the TV show Billions. And I know it was a popular show. Everybody loved it. And that's always the first question I get is, you know, is it like Billions or how is it different? You know, and the way I compare it is, you know, I had a good friend growing up who became a fireman. And I remember one time saying, you know, I see all these shows, Chicago Fire and Rescue Me. Is that what it's like to be a fireman? And he said, you know what? There's a small percentage of that show that represents what I do, which is, you know, obviously climbing the stairs of a burning building and rescuing people and doing the exciting stuff and hopefully, you know, not getting killed. But he said, you know, we also have to wash the truck and clean up the firehouse and maintain the equipment and do safety training. And, you know, that the stuff that's not as much fun, but is necessary. And you don't see that in a TV show about firemen. And Billions is the same way, right? There are definitely elements of that show that represent what the hedge fund world is. It is exciting. It is challenging to find alpha out there in the markets. But I think that, let's face it, most TV shows, they just look at the headlines. They find those cases that are exciting, scandalous, and that makes for good Hollywood, for good media, right? So that's what they tend to write episodes about. So there will always be kind of glimmers of truth, and you can learn about an industry from a show. But I tell people, don't believe too much. It's not nearly as sensational as TV would like you to think. So you know, a couple things kind of that kind of come to mind when I think about things that I've learned. I mean, the first one, and we've touched on this a little bit, is the competition, you know, not only between hedge funds to pull alpha or additional return on top of the beta of the market itself, it is incredible. It's to the extent that I've never seen anything like it. I mean, you look at Campbell as an example, which was a quantitative hedge fund. You know, we scoured the world for some of the smartest PhDs that we could possibly find. I mean, these are people that, you know, just having a coffee with them in the morning and a 15-minute chat, I walked out of the kitchen and my mind was completely blown. I mean, people who are just on a whole nother level from the average person from an intelligence standpoint. And we hired armies of these people to just study the markets and data coming out of the markets. To create algorithms and models that could find even the smallest little, you know, couple of basis points worth of an advantage in the market, something that hopefully other people hadn't yet discovered. And then taking that and hopefully finding 100 of those and adding them up and creating a portfolio that would give our clients, you know, not only a great return relative to the market, but hopefully one that's non-correlated, right? That tends to go up and down when the regular market is not going up and down, right? That truly can help diversify your portfolio. So if there's an aha moment for me about hedge funds, it's that they need to tick two boxes in a portfolio, right? They need to enhance returns. They have to be worth it. They're not cheap, right? To run a hedge fund is expensive, which is why the fees are high. And you have to compensate them for finding this unique return profile. But at the same time, they also have to diversify. They have to not just be what you could get if you and I bought the S&P 500. They have to be different. They have to differentiate themselves in a way where it's worth paying those expensive fees for them. Yeah. So at the end of the day, what I saw over my 25 years in hedge funds is that it got more and more competitive, which meant you had to spend more and more money on whether it was data or people to get that competitive advantage. And so I think as an industry, what you've seen is that hedge funds, you know, have gotten bigger, right? The successful ones, the assets flow into them. They have more capital. They can then spend more on these resources. They have more success. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling kind of prophecy, right? That the bigger get better, if you will. And that my only disappointment in saying that is that when I started in the industry, you know, two people, you and me, Jay, could get together with some good ideas and $10 million of friends and family money, and we could go start a hedge fund and we could be competitive. You don't see that anymore, right? I mean, right. Startups in the hedge fund space are usually a really, you know, exciting portfolio manager at a big hedge fund who says, I really want to run my own shop. And so the founder of that hedge fund says, okay, great. I'm going to give you $100 million and nine of my friends are going to give you $100 million and we're going to launch you with $1 billion and you're going to be a big player from the first day that you start, because we know that that's what's involved in being competitive in the industry. So I think, you know, on that front, you know, unfortunately, it's evolved to a place where, you know, the average person, it's hard for them to get their start. So my advice would be, you know, work hard, get the best education you can, intern, and hopefully, you know, you can get a shot at working at one of the bigger firms.
Wow, that's amazing. It reminds me of Ray Dalio, the Ray Dalio book, The Quantitative Analysis, and all the things that he talked about. You know, I mean, it was really a great book. I really enjoyed it. And also the, you know, made me think about billions, because I know they get like 3%. I mean, this is a TV show. They get 3%, 30% of the profits, and they're managing $30 billion. I mean, something like that is what I recall. Just thinking, oh my gosh, there's no telling how much money. $30 billion, they're getting 3% management fee and 30% of the profits. That's just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the average hedge fund fee when I started was, to your point, 2 and 20. So 2% management fee on assets, and then 20% of the profits that they would make for their clients as their incentive or performance fee. And now, granted, that's come down with competition. I think the average right now is probably closer to, call it 1.5 and 15 or 17. But that, you know, when you think about the average mutual fund probably charges between, you know, 25 and 75 basis points management fee. To get double that or four times that in management fee, and then to get this performance fee bonus, right. It's a much more lucrative world. But as I said before, it's a much more difficult world to produce those returns in an uncorrelated way. And so, you know, the best of the best out there need to be compensated, because, you know, if someone won't pay those fees, someone else will, right?
Oh yeah,
to be able to get to that alpha.
When I was in New York, I think it's during the pandemic or right before, and I was meeting with a good friend of mine, Greg Lippman. You may have heard about him from Big Short. And Greg started that whole, you know, the mortgage-backed security deal. And Greg and I are good friends, because I knew his dad from several gambling trips in Vegas, but that's a different story, a different time. Hey, great guy. And so I was talking to him and I said, man, how's business? He goes, you know what? He goes, right now, he said, a lot of these companies that we're coming to that, and I can't mention names, but some of these investors that are in his hedge fund are telling him, hey, look, we need you to go to 1.5 or send us our money back. And he goes, well, we can't send your money back, because, you know, they just say, hey, sue me. You know, I mean, they're just like, they're stepping on the lines now saying, we don't want to be charged all this. And he's like, you know, if you see the movie, you know, he's got the real smart guy, which he's right there next to him in his office, which is pretty cool, in the lipstick building. But he also talks about, man, you know what? You just gotta go, and you don't have the fees that you did at one time, so you're not able to hire the best talent out there, and you have to perform better, you know? So I see how it goes, and unfortunately, you know, somebody out there goes, well, I'm a startup. I don't have the track record, but I'll charge you less, and all of a sudden it's just a snowball effect. So the guys, the big guys in the industry, you know, like Ray Dalio, and of course he has a huge success, and he can probably call the shots what he wants, but these other people, they have to modify their talents. Hey, but let's talk about this. Let's kind of move on. I know I don't want to take up a lot of your time, Michael. I appreciate you being on, but I want to talk about this because I love doing this, and this is what the show's about. When you talk about 16 to 20 year olds and listening to what we're talking about and going, is Wall Street in my future? If so, you know, tell me something else. So you've had a lot of great success. You've had some failures. You picked yourself up. You are where you are today. Very thankful for that. I know you are too. But you also give back, and you're talking to a lot of students in universities right now and mentoring a lot. Tell me about that. Tell me, how do you do that?
Well, you know, I can't remember how it first started, but somebody along the way, you know, you have to remember that running a quantitative hedge fund, we hired a lot of professors either on a part-time basis or out of academia. And many of our PhDs went back and forth between some of the, you know, biggest and most profound universities in the country. So somewhere along the way in dealing with these big universities, somebody asked me, you know, a little bit like you did to be on this podcast. They said, hey, could you come in and share just a little bit about your career path, you know, how you got to where you are, what you've learned along the way with some of our students. And I did it, and I had just an absolute blast. I mean, the kids asked the best questions. I was supposed to be there for an hour. I think it turned into 2.5. And then even afterwards, they were following up with me. And so it just kind of, I started doing it on a regular basis. And then as word got out, I think now I'm up to 10 different universities that I give lectures on. And you know, the funny thing, Jay, is that I talked about hedge funds and Wall Street and the markets. And at the end, I'd always say, hey, you know, what questions do you have? And it was always the same question every single time. What do I do? How do I get a career on Wall Street? How do I get that start that you got? And it was never about like, where do I see interest rates going, or what's the best hedge fund? It was never, you know, what I thought it would be. It was always more, hey, can you help me? And, you know, looking back, I get it, right? Because young people, you know, whether they're in high school or college, they're preparing themselves. They're on that journey, and they're trying to figure out, how can I be a little bit better than the competition? So what I've done is basically made the last part of every class lecture, I've developed basically a list of things to think about. And I'm super happy to be able to share it with your listeners. So the first thing I tell people is, you know, you have with the internet more data than Jay and I ever did when it comes to doing research on potential career paths. But more importantly, let's say that you've got your sights on a company. You're going in for an interview, for an internship, or for a job. The amount of research that you can do on the person that you're meeting with through LinkedIn and just bios and other information on the internet, the amount of information you can really pull about that company, it's amazing to me. Because when you and I were doing that, Jay, 20, 30 years ago, we had nothing. We would ask a few questions of a few people that maybe knew the person we were meeting with. But other than that, we were flying blind. And so I tell young people, there's so much at your fingertips, sometimes almost overwhelming. But number one is you got to do your research, right? Particularly when I talk about interviewing, it's obvious to the people you're meeting with whether or not you've done research on them and their company or not. So at your own peril, you know, don't do a few Google searches and start reading up on the folks that you're going to be meeting with. You know, the second thing is there are all these wonderful designations that you can study for, particularly specific to finance, but I'm sure across all industries. I mean, the CFA program has really blown up over the last, call it 10, 15 years. Many employers look at that over an MBA. When you and I were coming up, an MBA was kind of, that was the degree that a lot of people in business, you know, were looking for. You could get that Ivy League MBA, then, you know, the world was yours. And now the CFA has gotten so challenging that many people think it's harder to obtain than an Ivy League MBA. So, and that's something you can do in your own time while you're working, while you're studying. It's not terribly expensive, but it's tough. It's competitive. There's plenty of other designations. There's the CMT, the CAIA for alternative investments. There's the CRM for risk professionals. There's even something called the Bloomberg Market Concepts, which I tell people at a bare minimum, if you're going into finance, you're probably going to have to use a Bloomberg terminal at some point. Go on and take that certification so that you can put on your resume that you know how to use a Bloomberg terminal. And doesn't cost that much, doesn't take that long. So some great stuff there. I've mentioned internships a bunch of times. I interned, that was a differentiator for me back when I was in college when no one even knew what interning was. It wasn't paid. I had to work a part-time job on the side, but I worked for Dean Witter Reynolds as an intern and really learned the ropes, if you will. It helps you because so many young people go for a job and they say, they're not going to hire me because I don't have experience. Well, if they don't give me a job, how do I get experience? Well, you know what? That's why you intern. You intern so that you can get experience. And I tell people, listen, it's good on two fronts. One, great path to employment. I love hiring interns because I tell people, you can fool me for an hour in a conference room in an interview, but you can't fool me for 3 months during the summer when you work for me 5 days a week, right? I know everything about you, your right. strengths, your weaknesses. Do you show up on time or late? You know, how do you get along with your teammates? All of that stuff. So I'm always going to hire an intern before somebody off the street. But then more importantly for the student, you get to actually, you know, test drive a career. And you know what? If you don't like it, that's actually a victory because you've just figured out that you probably saved yourself 5 years of your life. That career path wasn't for me. I'm gonna course correct and go a different direction. Whereas the person that gets the job in that field right out of college without interning or talking to anyone about it or doing their research, they're going to realize, wake up 3 years down the road that, oh my gosh, this is not for me, and have to completely shift, change companies, change jobs. And so on so many levels, gosh, what an absolute mistake if you don't intern either during high school, college, or both. The next one I'd say was clubs, right? There's finance clubs, investment clubs. Most universities will have a student-run endowment fund where you can pretend you basically be a portfolio manager and run a small amount of money for the endowment. That's incredible experience. Networking, right? Jay, you and I use LinkedIn in business, but we didn't have that when we were coming up. I tell young people, if you don't have a LinkedIn profile, I know you have six other social media accounts, but make sure you have a LinkedIn profile. And every person that you, whether it's professors, your friends' parents, other people that you meet that could be an interesting connection for you, connect with them on LinkedIn. Start building up, you know, that universe of contacts. And then, you know, last, I'll just say, I mentioned a couple things about interviewing, but, you know, goes back to research, right? You got to prepare. I tell people, you know, even if you're busy with your studies, if you're interviewing for a finance internship or a job, you got to read the front page of the Wall Street Journal or CNBC.com or watch Bloomberg in the morning of the interview just to get a flavor for what's going on in the market so that you really can kind of talk the talk the day of the interview. So preparation is absolutely key. You know, dress the part, right, Jay? You and I didn't have, we could have shown up in our sweats today for the podcast, but we're wearing our Sunday best. And there's a lot of young people in particular that are very casual when they interview. You know, be the one that stands out and look the part, whether they require that of you or not, particularly in this Zoom world where everyone has gotten pretty casual. The unexpected, right? There will be oddball questions that get thrown your way. We used to do that just to kind of see how someone would react. I was literally trading European stocks on that fateful day on September 11th when the planes flew into the World Trade Center, where I had plenty of friends. You know, that's where I started my career. And I had to react to that and still be able to manage risk effectively in the marketplace. You know, a lot of times in interviews, they will ask you questions to kind of catch you off guard and see, do you panic or do you focus and give them the best possible answer that you can? You know, for traders in particular, we used to give math questions just to see whether or not people could, you know, do math in their head or were they going to pull out a calculator. That was very telling for us. And then finally, and this is probably, I think, one of the most important things is follow-up. You know, you have to send a thank you note. And I would always prefer, you know, make it a handwritten thank you note. I don't know about you, Jay, but I probably get 3 pieces of real mail in my office a week. I get thousands of emails and they all get lost. But for somebody to actually take the time to write me a note and send that, that's going to have an impact on me. And I think, you know, if there's an overarching summary to this, it's, you know, when you think about the internships and the research, the most important thing, whether it's finance or a different career path, find something that you're passionate about. You know, I believe, Jay, that you and I have been successful in our careers for one reason. We love what we do. I get up every single morning and I'm excited to go to work, right? And if I didn't love what I did, I'd hit the snooze bar 5 times. And once I got to work, I wouldn't have the energy that I have about doing what I do. I absolutely am passionate about making money for clients, helping them solve their needs. And that's what makes me good at what I do. So the onus I put on students is find that thing that you're passionate about and then go after it. And you'll be way more successful.
Great thoughts, man. Interns, great on going to a business to see if that's what they want to do or not. That's awesome. Personal notes, that's great. Your interviews. We had the Value Fund books, you know, that were so thick that when I started back in the 80s on the stock market, thinking about how the Value Funds books were, and now they can click on their iPhone and learn anything and everything they want to know. Probably huge profile on the person that they're interviewing with, you know. So what a lot of great information there. That was great. I need to go back and listen to that again because there was such great information on that.